Everyone. It's a pleasure to be here. This is my first ASA meeting, and there have been some wonderful, stimulating talks, many things I wanted to respond to, but I thought, well, I get to talk for 20 minutes, so I'll, perhaps some of the things I say will have connections. Your comment about cell biology, for example, a lot of people move to molecular biology because it's much more replicable. Okay, well then, it's probabilistic there too, yes. So I'm going to talk to you about the origin of enzymes. And I'm an experimental biologist, so we're returning to where we started this morning with, And I'm going to talk to you about experiments done in bacteria, not bacteriophage. My model system is E. coli, and so what you see here is the E. coli genome, and some of the proteins which are produced from that genome. And the main point of this slide is that proteins come in many different folded forms, and it's the fold, the particular three-dimensional structure that they adopt, which is significant in their function. The question is, where did they all come from? I'm going to focus in on the origin of protein superfamilies and families, which is why this slide here. Protein scientists look at structures, they group them according to similarity of form. Proteins that share an overall fold structure can be categorized according to their related structures, their similarities, and they're hierarchically, they break down fold, superfamily, family, and then the individual proteins. That similarity of structure is one of the arguments used for the idea that these families arose by a process of duplication and modification, divergence over time. Here is the protein family that I work on, or it's actually a superfamily, the PLP-dependent aminotransferases. And you can see an example of structures from that family and one way of organizing them according to a hierarchical evolutionary relationship. It's a huge superfamily, and there are multiple different ways of organizing them according to sequence similarity and structure. And you can find, this is one version. If you go to SCOP, which is the structural categorization of proteins, they're categorized differently. Just depends on which particular aspects of their structure you want to use. As I said, my goal is to ask the question, is similarity of form something that is evidence for their common descent? And the reason I'm asking the question is because I have doubts about whether the mechanism of mutation and selection is sufficient to bridge the gap in these families of proteins. So, zooming in on this superfamily, I'm showing this slide here so that you can see something about the range and the similarity across the family. These two here are isozymes. They share the same function. These have vastly different chemistries, but they're all categorized in the same superfamily because you can see some of the structural aspects that make them look alike. They tend to have this beta sheet complex in common, but here it's breaking down some. And there are other aspects of their chemistry. They all use the same cofactor called PLP for short. And we took unique members of all the proteins that are in this superfamily that we obtained from SCOP a few years ago. We did structural comparisons, identified how similar they were in their structure using an algorithm that aligns the backbones, for those who are technically interested. And then we grouped them according to their pairwise similarity. So this is a pairwise tree. It's not an evolutionary tree. It's not based on sequence analysis or phylogenetics. What this indicates is any pair of proteins here. Each of these codes represents a unique protein. For example, these are the isozymes I showed you earlier. Any line that connects two indicates the structural distance between the two. A long line, they're distant in structure. A very short line, they're very close together. The other information that's on this graph is that we then compared their chemistries. If they shared a substrate or a reaction type, then the line is solid. If their chemistry is different, there's something unique or different in their reactions, then the line is dashed. So from this, we wanted to pick a pair of proteins to investigate. We wanted them to have close structural similarity and both be present in E. coli, that's the system we work with, and we wanted them to have different chemistries. And as you can see here in the circle, that's the pair we picked. It's among the closest in structural distance in the whole superfamily that has a unique chemistry. And these are the proteins. On the left, that's what we call BioF. It's a dimer formed from identical subunits, has two reactive sites in the dimer, and it carries out the first dedicated step in the making of biotin, the vitamin biotin. The other protein we call cable for short because its symbol is KBL. It's involved in threonine degradation. To show you how similar they are, this is these are both dimers. This is a monomer of each aligned according to their alpha carbon backbone, and the angstrom difference is on the order of 2 angstroms. Then I extracted from these structures the amino acid side chains that are involved directly in the chemistry. These side chains are conserved in the family. All proteins in this family share these side chains. And the ones in blue come from BioF, the ones in green come from cable. What do you notice? They have exactly the same amino acid side chains in very similar positions, yet they carry out different chemistries. Now, the proteins are not identical. This is the chemistry for those of you who are chemists. BioF takes an amino acid and a CoA conjugated long chain, does a transfer, and then liberates carbon dioxide and CoA. Cable takes an amino acid and a much shorter CoA conjugate and puts them together and liberates CoA, but there's no carbon dioxide given off. So we want to find out if we can take BioF, cable, and make it behave like BioF. Simple question. The rationale for asking the question is these two proteins are very closely related in structure. If transitions between proteins to new functions, genuinely new chemistries, are possible, then something like this transition must be possible. So how do we do it? We start out by identifying which amino acids are essential for BioF to carry out its function by testing BioF. We look at its structure. We compare 50 different BioF sequences from the bacterial kingdom and identify conserved sequences. Then we test those identified sequences in BioF, find out if we change them to be like cable in those positions, what happens. Once we've done that, then the next step is to go to cable, convert those same positions to look like BioF, and see if that switches the activity. And then the good thing about this system is that it's all tested in vivo. We have an assay system where we can take our mutated protein on a plasmid, put it into cells that lack BioF, have everything else they need to make biotin, plate them on medium that lacks biotin, and ask if they grow. So what did we find? Well, first of all, this is a comparison of BioF sequence to cable sequence. Everywhere you see a line, the proteins are already identical. Everywhere you see a black dot, those are conserved sequences among different BioF sequences. We looked for places where BioF was conserved, but different in cable, and those are identified by red dots. There's some 15 of those red dots. We tested each of them singly. Only the one in the red box had any effect that we could detect in vivo on activity. The red dot at position 152 knocked out activity. Interestingly enough, that amino acid is far away from the active site and on the surface of the protein. Then we looked at the two proteins, aligned them structurally, and we looked for amino acids that were in the vicinity of the active site, but were distinct between cable and BioF. And those are in boxes, blue, yellow, and green. We tested those as groups, in part because we had already found out that single mutations had very little effect on function. That's not unusual. It usually takes a number of mutations to destabilize the protein enough to knock out function unless it's involved directly in some process involved in catalysis. So, what are the results? You change each of these groups individually, no result. You combine them one by one, no result. They all have negative effect on BioF, but when you convert cable at those positions to look like BioF, there's no rescue of the ability to make biotin. Now, we didn't test each of the amino acids in each group singly, except for the third group. We tested each of those singly. No single mutation knocked out activity. You needed to change all of them at changing all of them at once did knock out activity. So our goal was to figure out, okay, how many mutations would it take to convert cable to BioF? The answer is 7 genetic events. Why? Because the way the codon amino acid mapping is, it takes on average 1.5 bases to make the right switch. 7 genetic events. Now, let me remind you, that's a small structural change on the whole scale of what has to be explained to account for the origin of the family. Okay, base change, plus gene duplication. Okay. Now, this work was published last year in the journal Biocomplexity. It's available online if you want the details. Is what I report to you here unique? No. Among protein engineers, people who try to change proteins for a living, for reasons independent of evolutionary studies, they find that converting proteins to genuinely new chemistry is difficult. If they start out with overlapping chemistries or substrate preferences, they can be shifted towards the desired result. But if there's genuinely new chemistry, it's very hard. There are only a few cases where it's been done. This is a review by authors well-respected in the field. You notice that they're surprised by this difficulty. Here's another review from other people, Francis Arnold's lab. They work using what's called directed evolution primarily. Directed evolution is a sort of an analog for the process of mutation and selection, only speeded up because you make the mutations happen in the lab and you select in the lab and you can go through multiple rounds of many, many copies of the gene. When people started out doing this technique in protein engineering, they thought it would be the solution to all their problems, but it turned out not to be the case. And as they point out here, the kinds of things that may be impossible to reach without making a jump of several mutations are new catalytic activity, or an activity for which the starting point has no overlap, no measurable activity. Sorry, I went back. Why is it so hard to shift proteins? We perhaps have been thinking about proteins in the wrong way. This is a schematic diagram representing a protein. This side here in red is the active site. This is where all the direct contact with the substrate happens, and the process of converting substrate to product takes place. The active site is not a little Lego block you plug into a structure. It's dependent, the structure has to be supporting the active site, hold it in the right configuration. But beyond that, there are many long-distance interactions which influence the chemistry at the active site. Shifts in charge, reconfigurations, a whole host of things that have to happen for enzymes to work. In other words, proteins are more like global designs than they are like static structures. And it's not possible to take one active site and put it on another scaffold and expect it to work. In fact, that is what I did. By making all those substitutions, I essentially converted Cable's active site to look like BioF. But it didn't work. Just this last week in New Scientist was an article describing this difficulty. I'd like to call your attention to this right here. Can you read it? Should I read it to you? Biologically inspired catalysts could usher in a revolution in chemistry if only we can figure out the best way to create them. The difficulty is this. We don't know enough about protein structure to predict what things need to be changed to convert function. We've tried that. It's called rational design. Neither does a purely directed evolution process work, because the search space of all possible mutations is too large, and we can't generate libraries large enough to cover all the possibilities. The third way that's now being tried at the University of Washington by Baker's lab is to combine computational studies where they model the substrate they want to work on, and then they generate a structure that would perhaps interact with it properly in a computer. Then they do a search of all possible proteins that are known to find the one that's closest. Then they go through the process of rational design and directed mutation. They've succeeded in making new catalytic functions. The difficulty is that even after all that work, the activity levels are still really low, as they admit, compared to natural enzymes. So, punchline. How feasible is it for an unguided process to make a new function when the requirement is that you acquire multiple mutations at once, say 7? Doug Axe, who I work with, developed a population genetics model based on bacteria. This is a model for bacteria. It's not a eukaryotic model. The idea is that bacteria in the wild go through what's called a boom and bust cycle. One bacterium can found a whole new population and grow till the medium, its food supply, is exhausted. Then, by the luck of the draw, a few from that population may succeed in founding new populations in another organism. So, in a global population, this is a, for those who do modeling of this kind, this is a not a discrete model, it's a continuous population model. And it's also not a model that requires fixation of each step. It's a stochastic tunneling model where you can have any of these mutations arising at any time. You track them through the population. What happens is this. I don't think you can see them, but here you have different populations of bacterium. Some of them have red X's on them. There's one here. It's really hard to see even for me. There's one there. There's one there. If the population of a bacterium starts with a single bacterium and goes up to, say, 10 to the 9th, 10 to the 12th, and then someone, bacterium from that population, is the next founder of a new population, what are the odds that a mutation that happens relatively late in the process, being the founding cell, very small. Only time that that mutation has a chance of continuing in the population and reaching fixation is if the mutation happens early, or it just happens to be so that all this population is mutated, or it happens that just the lucky mutation is the one that founds a new population. Then it sweeps through and you're likely to be able to continue. So you run the model forward. What do you get? It was published in 2010 in the same journal, Biocomplexity. The answer is this. If you have no cost for carrying a duplicated gene while it's being randomly mutated through drift, then you can, the limit to what you can accomplish in terms of number of mutations you can acquire before you get a new function is where this dotted line is. So this is the specific base changes required, and this is the log of the waiting time in generations. And using standard mutation rates, estimates for generation duration and time, you plug in the numbers also for gene loss and gene duplication rate. This red line here represents the case where there is no cost to carrying the duplicate. The limit is 6 mutations. If there is a cost, it's off the charts here, and it's down around 3 genetic events. And as you can see, you're off the scale in terms of what's within reach probabilistically. So, our conclusion is this. Unguided genetic events, innovations, have to be very common, surprisingly common, even to survive, and then occur within just a few limited steps in order to be something that will eventually become fixed in the population. Innovations more than 3 are likely to not be successful. We base that on the fact that there is a cost to carrying duplicated DNA in bacteria. They rapidly delete it. This seems to exclude most cases where you require a general change in chemistry. So what does that mean? It means that just because two things look alike doesn't mean it's going to be easy to convert one into the other. And here's the objection that's been raised against our work most commonly. You didn't start from the right protein. You chose 2 proteins that are currently in existence. They're evolutionary cousins. One didn't evolve from the other. You need to start with the ancestral protein. Okay. What that means, though, is that you're saying if evolution is so constrained that you have to start with precisely the right starting point, then it's a tacit admission that the conversion process is hard. Nobody disagrees with our results that it's hard to change cable to BioF. But they fall back on this idea that there must be some sort of ancestral form that it would have worked on. Here's what I say. Then you have to postulate that the first cell had to have some sort of special category of proteins, highly plastic, easily evolvable, catalytically generalists, totally different than what we generally find in biochemistry today, to get that to work. Or perhaps it was front-loaded, or perhaps it was guided. So, for example, if you look at the minimal genome set of what's essential in E. coli, it's about 300 genes that are essential. That's 300 genes. How many of them are PLP-dependent catalysts? 1. Yet, somehow, in that minimal cell starting point, we got to this. So, thank you very much. Possible that we might understand where to start from a little better. These proteins are all ancient. They go back to the origin of the first cell. We don't have, some of the work that's been done reconstructing evolutionary pathways has used much more modern proteins, and it's easier to identify ancestral proteins by sequence comparison, et cetera, amino acid comparisons. But I think the problem still will remain that some transitions are going to be too hard, or we have to start with something different in the way of what first proteins look like. Transduction pathways, you mean from other organisms? Or?
I mean from interactions with the membrane.
Wow, I have no idea if anyone's thought about that. Don't know. I've seen the paper. Yeah. What should be stated is that E. coli is already capable of metabolizing citrate. The only change is that normally it does it under anaerobic conditions, and the pathway for importing citrate from the environment is shut off under aerobic conditions. He grew the cells in medium that contains a high amount of citrate under starvation conditions. So any cell that changed its regulation so that suddenly it could import citrate under aerobic conditions would have a tremendous advantage. I don't know how many steps it takes to do that, but I've looked at the chromosome, and all it would take is one rearrangement that moves the citrate operon next to a new promoter, and you'd have the change. The whole pathway is there. It's normally repressed when the cells are growing in the presence of oxygen. If you change the regulation by mutating the promoter or moving it to a new location, you're going to turn it on under aerobic conditions, and it'll work. Mm-hmm. Sure. Some protein folds are much easier to shift than others, and there are promiscuous enzymes. And it makes sense for cytochrome P450 to be that way. Its job is to chew up toxic chemicals, so it needs to be able to react with a lot of different substrates. There have been some papers published in Nature using other proteins that are highly promiscuous, and you can shift them to different. You know, if they have six substrates they'll react with, you can shift them to favor one specific one over the others. That's possible. We don't dispute that. It also is probably dependent on which particular enzyme you're looking at. Some enzymes require very little in the way of catalytic activity. They just break hydrogen. They break a bond. And the reactive site sits on the outside. So those are easy to shift, hydrolases, things like that. Our enzyme, the PLP-dependent enzymes, happen to be very complex. The substrate has to penetrate deep into the interior of the enzyme, and it's actually a two-step process. One substrate in, transfer, it leaves. Second substrate in, another transfer. So it's a complicated reaction, requires a lot more sophistication. Sensitive in what sense?
No, I mean the result.
Okay. The model itself doesn't specify which seven, and just how hard is it to get any seven mutations grouped together. My experimental results say we need at least seven. I suspect it's many more than that to accomplish the conversion. So basically, Doug's population model says that any suite of changes for any protein that requires more than three is probably beyond reach. My test is specific to BioF and Cable, but remember, it was one of the shortest changes. And it may be that we are in the process of testing this. There are, nine other different paralogs to BioF in E. coli. We're going to test them all one by one. We're going to look for organisms. There was a paper published in Japan a few years back of an enzyme that actually is proposed to have both activities in the same enzyme, but that's only in vitro. We're going to look and see if it works in E. coli, if it can carry out BioS function. If it can't, then can we mutate it because it's supposedly closer? I think there's lots more work to be done. I just am raising the question. Not in the population model. It's a simple stochastic process, and the mutations occur anywhere in the protein. You need A, B, C, D, E, F.
Thank you very much. Just thank you again.